commencing countdown. T minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition.
What an incredible smell, you scum!
Dear Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This ain't happening.
Inconceivable!
Autobots, transform!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode number 6.
Poorly photoshopping ourselves into the moon landing.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Adam.
And today we're going to start off our intro discussion with a post that we found through Futurismic from Nathan Bransford, who is an agent for the Curtis Brown... Is that Limited? Is that what that stands for?
Probably.
Yeah, Curtis Brown Limited. I'm just going to assume it's limited. You can tell us what LTD stands for. I don't know. It's some business thing. Whatever. So he said in his article thingy that he not only thinks that we're moving away from an era where fiction is filtered by publishers, we're moving away from that and now going into one where the consumer does the filtering. He not only says he thinks that's where we're going, but that's what he wants.
If he actually means that, then it kind of also means that he doesn't really much care for his job. He might mean it in like an idealist sort of sense, where he thinks that would be better for, you know, the art form as a whole.
Oh, well, I'm going to disagree with that.
I'm just saying he might think this. Because, you know, then the public would have more choices, but you'd still have, you know, things that bubble to the top because of, you know, unwarrantedly bubble to the top, you know, through hype and all that. So
yeah.
Maybe... If this does happen, maybe editors and agents won't be as prominent, but, you know, publicists might be even more prominent because you need someone to actually push your wagon, you know, through the traffic jam.
That's just like a silly argument, though, because if that's what he thinks, that this would give you more choice. I mean, it would obviously give you more choice, but it's when you look at the market now, just the stuff that's published by legitimate publishers, there's too much stuff for anybody to read anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know the numbers. I know almost 300,000 books are published every year. I can't remember what percentage of that is from the POD publishers, which most of them are the self-publishing vanity publishers. But a huge chunk of that is from the Big Six. So, and that's too much. I mean, I think only what's his name, Larry Nolan from Off Blog of the Fallen. He's the only guy I know that probably reads like 500 books a year.
Of Blog of the Fallen.
Of Blog of the Fallen, excuse me. So it's just like, that's a silly argument. And I think you're absolutely right. Like, does he not realize that by really wanting this, like, that he is effectively ushering in an era where his job is more or less irrelevant? I mean, when you get to that point where if there's really no reason for anybody to go the traditional route anymore, which is what this would be, what is the point of the agent? Why do you need the agent anymore? The only thing that agents do, are supposed to do, really, is to be a mediator between the author and the publisher. They're like that connection that gets you out of the slush pile, more or less. I mean, they do a lot more, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, with foreign rights and film rights and audio rights, they're the business part of your writing endeavor, so you don't have to worry about that.
Oh, okay, I mean, I guess for the for like movie rights, you would still need an agent. But other than that, in this era where publishers are no longer the ones doing the filtering and the consumers doing it, that means that an author effectively doesn't need an agent. All you need is either really good brains for marketing and publicity, or you just hire a publicity person. So this is just a stupid idea. And I have whole lots of problems with this whole thing, because I think that if this were to come true, that we ended up in a world where consumers do the filtering instead of publishers, I think that it will effectively destroy literature as a art form that matters. Literature will die.
It's a bit
absolutely
dramatic.
It'll kill literature.
I don't think it'll kill it. I think people will just be so overwhelmed with choices that they will, you know, kind of, you know, only pay attention to the authors they've always read and try to get, you know, books from the era when from the era of traditional publishing. Because, I mean, honestly, the consumers are still the filter. What consumers buy dictates what gets published. The publisher is just like this initial filter, you know, this big widescreen filter that, you know, captures all of the flack and, you know, lets the better options through. But it's still, you know, up to the consumer to choose.
Well, that's right. But the consumer isn't having to choose from a sea of stuff of subpar work. They're only choosing from what the publishers consider their like line that they don't cross. We don't go below that line. Everything is supposed to be above this line. Now, that's not to say that stuff doesn't slip through the cracks. You know, like, I would not consider Twilight to be great writing, but a few examples of bad books from traditional publishers doesn't meet up with the opposite you get, where it's only a few dozen examples of good books from non-traditional avenues. So I agree that we could still go back to the era of traditional publishing, but that's stuff that was already out there. When we're talking about the future of literature, if the only way to keep literature alive is to be looking backwards, that's not keeping it alive. That's just doing the same crap that English departments have been doing for the last 150 years, where all they look at is the quote-unquote canon. You know, like, oh, we're going to all read Jane Austen. What do you freaking do? And then it's taken them 150 years just to acknowledge that, hey, you know, this other stuff, it matters. Why don't we talk about it?
Jane Austen doesn't matter.
Well, but you know what I mean. Like,
I know, I'm just saying. Jane Austen doesn't matter. I've read it. It's, oh.
But, I mean, at the same time, the whole thing about this is that really irks me is that it effectively makes it my job as a consumer now to find the work that I want to read. And by that, I mean not just books that are in the genre I like, that have synopsises that sound good, but like I now have to go and do all of this work to make sure that books that I'm spending my money on are now books that are written well and so on, you know, that have been edited, that have whatever, all of these things that a traditional publisher effectively offers me. I now have to do that as the consumer. And for me, that would destroy reading. I shouldn't have to work to find books that are at the minimum of my like writing requirement level. That's not something I'm going to do as a consumer. That's a waste of my time, and I shouldn't have to gamble with my money. That's the bottom line.
I mean, I honestly don't see how we could ever, like, how there will ever be a world without large publishers. I mean, even if, you know, 20% of books go to purely electronic, they're still going to need, you know, publishers to put those together as well. You know, publishers will find a way to adapt. Even though publishers have been, you know, these big guys have been around for over 100 years in some cases, I mean they've gone through the same cultural and societal upheavals as everyone else, and they're still around. They will find a way, even if it seems like they're stuck in a Baroque system now.
Well, that's true too. I think they're a little bit sluggish right now, and they get a lot of flack for like the ebook stuff because they seem to be behind the times. But I think the thing that people keep forgetting is that publishers, their bottom line is they're interested in profit. They like books too, but if a book for them does not sell, or if they can't make money off it, it's not a venture they're generally going to take. That's just, they're a business. So when it comes to like the ebooks and these other forms of things, they're a little bit slow to get on the mark because A, they don't know where those industries are going to go. B, when they do figure out that those are industries that are going somewhere, they're trying to think of ways to make that profitable. You know, and like with ebooks, everybody says, oh, well, they should be cheap. Well, there's a reason why they're expensive. You don't I found out this the hard way. I used to be those people who are like, oh, ebooks should be like 99 cents because they're just easy. You just put it in a file. Well, no. Actually, when you just shove a document or a PDF or whatever and you just try to make it an Amazon file, it Fs up the formatting like mad. I mean, the amount of work that goes into fixing it line by line is insane. I don't even want to do it. I hate it. Like, I can imagine. Like, this is why I would charge $11.99 for that, because after all of that pain and torture, like, I want to go and get a drink. after that. So, but they are slow, but they're going to get eventually. They're going to catch up. So, I mean, the agency model is just one model right now. In, you know, another year or so, they may come up with a better model. I don't know.
So we have almost a bonus question for you this week. And it's a simple one to tag along with this argument. Or not argument, but article. So why do you write? Is it because you just enjoy it, you know, for fun? Is it, you know, for the art of it, to reach an audience? Any reason at all, send in your answer.
Yeah, we'll give you information at the end, unless you already know it. You should already know it. But if not, that was a question that really came to me. Is it the whole idea, like when Bransford talks about what is the harm to a writer if you only are read by a few people, like if you only sell like 20 copies of a book? And that to me seems really to depend on your goal. If your goal is you want to make money, well, then there's a lot of harm to you because you basically just failed. If your goal is you just want the art, then you probably don't really care about the money. You know, you're just in it for making pretty words. And then, but if you want to reach an audience, then it's both. Then it matters to you that you sell to as many people as possible, and then you keep selling to as many people as possible. You want more people to read your work. That's kind of where I'm like a mix between the art and the audience. Like, I want people to read my work, and I want to make money doing it. That'd be great. I'd love to be J.K. Rowling and filthy rich, but it's more important to me that that people read my work, because isn't it the old saying, like, the worst thing for a writer is obscurity?
I don't know.
It's one of those old sayings. I think it's some saying that people say. I don't know what the exact wording is, but that you're effectively irrelevant if nobody knows you exist.
Yeah.
So
I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, why do you write, Adam?
I write because I think it's fun. It's a good time. I know I want to make a living at it. That's my ultimate goal. If I can, you know, support my family writing, and that'd be awesome. So I write, you know, for myself. I write so one day I can hope to make money at it. And I really do want, I mean, I wouldn't write if I didn't want people to read it. There'd be no point. So I would love to have just people worship my books and me.
So it's kind of all of the above, cool. Then.
Yeah, I guess it is.
You're like, I'm a little bit of everything. I like writing, and it's fun, and I want people to read, and I want money. Mm-hmm. I want it all. That sounds good. You should be able to do all three. Let's hope you do.
Don't forget the worshiping. I also like that. Effigies,
the worshiping.
And sacrifices. You know, everything that goes along with being, you know, a true cult figure.
I don't know about the sacrifices, but I certainly would really get a kick if somebody wanted to do, like, they wanted to do a party with a theme off of something I had written, because I would get I would want to go to that party. That would be really cool.
The ultimate coolness would be if there were a convention around all my stories. That would be, like there is for the Hitchhiker's Guide. That would be awesome.
Yep, and they have it for Pratchett, too. There's a Discworld convention.
That makes sense.
Yep. Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff that are, like, for TV series. Like, you have a Doctor Who conventions, Stargate conventions.
So many more people watch TV than read.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. Alrighty, well, I think we're about done with this topic. If you guys have any opinions on this, we'd love to hear from you, because we may have people who have very different opinions, and I don't know, maybe you disagree with us, and we're crazy. I don't know. Well, I mean, Adam's crazy. I'm mostly normal.
Effigies and sacrifices.
See, exactly. So we're going to come right back after the music with a few news bits, so be right back.
And we're back with just a few news articles. Should go pretty quickly, because I'm guessing our main discussion is going to go for quite a while. This first one was one I was excited about until I looked closer at it. It's about AE, which is the new Canadian science fiction magazine that used the site Kickstarter to raise $11,000, which is incredible to start their magazine. And they did it because they want to create the first, you know, or the only CIFWA, you know, pro-paying, CIFWA-eligible pro-paying market in Canada, which is awesome. You know, it's like, sweet, another propane market. But they want, they're going to have a strict minimum of 75% Canadian authors.
Yeah.
Which just sucks completely.
Yeah,
for
that,
us.
That completely ruined it for me. So,
you know, I mean, if you it's hard enough to get into a propane magazine as it is. And so if you're American and you want to submit there, your chances are even smaller. I mean, you're going to have to be, it seems like you're going to have to be a big name to be an American and get into this magazine. I would just skip it altogether. Who cares?
Well, not even American, since 75% is specifically Canadian. The other 25% is anywhere in the world.
I know, but that's mostly America.
No, you'll get UK, you'll get Europe.
We're mostly the world.
You'll get Australia.
We're mostly the world. Australia, there's no way Australia is going to submit to this magazine.
They might. There's a lot of Australian science fiction and fantasy writers. A lot.
Do you think because Canada's still kind of in the British Commonwealth that they give people from England and Australia a bye? Does that count being Canadian? It's kind of all the same thing.
No. No, it doesn't. No. No. In fact, I think Canadians would get really pissed at you for making that.
I don't care. They're Canadians. There's like 32 million of them.
Yeah, and when they invade the United States, I would like to be on their good side, so.
I won't be able to stop laughing because of the accents. I love Canadian accents.
They don't even have Canadian accents. Hey,
I live a few hours from Canada, okay? I know.
Some of them have accents, but
of
most
course.
Of them do
it's
not.
It's a joke. It's a joke, I know. There are more accents, you know, across in Minnesota than there are in Canada I've come across. Man, you should hear this. I love this. It's so funny.
Anyway, so, and the only other thing to really mention about that is they have a little video on their page, and they were mentioning Canadian authors, and they brought up a bunch of people, and I looked them up, and I realized these people are only sort of Canadian. Like for example, they mentioned William Gibson and Spider Robinson. Both of them were born in America. They're Americans. They were raised and lived in America, and then they got dual citizenship in Canada, which, I mean, I guess that makes you Canadian, but that's, like, why didn't they mention somebody like Robert J. Sawyer, who is, like, 100% Canadian? Like, he didn't, like, come from Croatia and then, haha, I'm Canadian. Like, he's actually the big name, and I don't know. It's really weird that they mentioned a bunch of names of people that weren't really Canadian. I don't know.
Yeah, by their token, why isn't Peter Watts on there? I mean, he's trapped in Canada till his felony charges expunged.
He's Canadian, though.
Peter Watts? Yeah. That's a joke. No, he's not. He's from America.
No, he's not. He's Canadian.
He's not. He lives in America.
He doesn't live in America either.
Then why would it matter if he's trapped in Canada?
Because he can no longer come to the United States.
Really?
Man, he's a convicted felon.
I know he's a convicted felon. I didn't know he was Canadian. That's far more surprising to me.
He's Canadian, and unfortunately, yeah, he's an Ottawa citizen, I think. Oh, no, never mind. No, I could be wrong. No, he's from Canada. Where's his damn biography? I don't know. I know he's Canadian. He lives in Canada. He's from Canada. He just comes to the U.S. to do conventions, and the whole big deal about him getting stuck in Canada wasn't so much that he got stuck and he can't go to America again. It was that he could go to prison.
Well, I apologize. I mean, just because it was a big deal that he was stuck in Canada, like when I was listening to the, you know, interviews and stuff.
Well, I apologize to Mr. Watts. He's also a marine biologist,
Mr. Canadian Watts.
Yeah, it's pretty nifty. Anyway, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, I feel sorry for Mr. Watts, though, because he got in trouble for what, if you've read the whole ordeal of what happened, it just sounds like a load of BS that what happened to him. And even when you go into the, when they went to the court and they talked about the transcripts, what actually happened, like, I don't know how any judge could feel right about himself, even saying that he's not allowed, that he's a convicted felon, but that he doesn't have to go to prison. Like, I don't know, it was ridiculous. But that's a different... That's kind of old hat now.
Yeah, back to the AE. I mean, I just hate, you know, magazines that have quotas of native authors. Because, you know, we live in the internet age. It's not hard to submit things to magazines. I mean, I submit to Andromeda Spaceways in Australia all the time. It's not a big deal to do that anymore. And now that Asimov's has, you know, e-subs, it's really not a big deal. So I probably won't even pick it up because... Why care about it?
Now I don't buy any magazines that are country specific unless they're special issues or it's like an anthology, a country specific anthology.
Yeah, I mean that's different.
That's completely different than this is the staple now. most of them will have to be Canadian authors, which I don't have a problem with Canadian authors getting published. I have a problem so much, like, why would I care about this magazine now since it's no longer relevant to me?
And, you know, Canada isn't very big. I mean, even if they have, you know, more, you know, average, on average, more authors than, you know, for, than, you know, they do for their size, you're just going to be reading the same names over and over again, pretty much. I mean, even more so than you do in the American magazines, which is saying something.
Yeah, probably. It's probably true, yeah.
It's going to be like a little writing group magazine.
Yeah, I mean, that really depends. I mean, I don't know too much about Canadian authors. I've read some of them, but I don't know what their writing world is like. Maybe somebody from Canada can yell at us and tell us we're wrong.
Probably. We probably just made Canada all mad somehow.
We're just going to make enemies with everyone. You know, we made feminists mad, and now we're pissing off Canadians.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
You said the F word,
man.
Oh,
I said the F word.
You did.
Oh, no.
Sean Duke said the F word. I didn't.
Yeah. Whatever. But
address your hate mail to World in a Satin Bag.
They used the word before we did, so whatever.
I'm not using it.
I'm sorry. No. The people who are for women's rights. Is that not what a feminist is now? I don't know.
Oof, you are digging it deep, man. You're digging it deep.
Anyway, we're going to move on to something else now since we've officially like alienated the universe. No, it's we. You pissed off Canadians. I've made the female population despise us. So,
you know, Canadians know I'm joking. I love hockey, you know. You know, I try to only buy Canadian maple syrup because it's delicious.
Do you like curling?
I love curling.
You liar.
No, seriously, I love it.
You're a liar.
No, I mean, I bowled for many years, and curling's like, you know, my winter brethren to bowling.
That's like an American saying he likes soccer. Like, that's an
I do. I love soccer. I mean, I'm bummed because my cable's out, so I can't watch the World Cup, but
soccer's
I'm still up to date. Oh, now you just made a billion people angry, including me, sir.
Well, I'm sorry. I played soccer, so.
So did I, which makes me appreciate it more.
No, I like the juice boxes at the end.
I dig soccer and curling.
Soccer's an interesting game. I just don't care because there's really no team for me to root for. So
America.
We suck. Like, we're ever going
to
win.
We've done well. We should have won the last game, but you know that referee
we tied
really
against
just
England.
That was amazing. I can't believe that happened.
We got handed over the goal. Like, that was not even a real goal. It was like it was just stupid.
Maybe that's why they took our last goal away in the Slovenia game.
I didn't watch the game, but I heard about that. But it's just like, what's the chance we're ever going to win? Like,
come on, have hope. Our team is actually looking pretty darn good this year.
No, they're not. They're not.
We are.
They've got two ties, man. They're looking terrible. Brazil's probably got like 1-12 games already.
In soccer, a tie is a good outcome.
No, it's not. It's a terrible outcome. Tying is a terrible thing. Okay. In the real world, in real sports, there's no such thing as a draw. There's not. In football, you don't have a draw. You go into overtime. Baseball, you go into overtime.
Moving on.
Just telling you. You gotta, none of this, like, why don't they have a kickoff like they have in hockey, like, where they have if they have a tie at the end, they do, like, the one against the goalie.
Shootout?
Yeah, shootout. Why don't they do that with a kickout?
Kickout, it's still a, you know, I think you still call it a shootout.
Whatever, but, shootout, kickout, you gotta kick it, football kickout, whatever. Why don't they do that?
They do in the important matches.
But these are all important matches. It's the World Cup. It's not like every other day they have
the preliminary rounds. Oh. It doesn't matter yet.
All right, whatever.
But moving on from that very far digression, Ridley Scott wants to make two Alien sequels for some unknown reason to me. The new one, I mean, is set 30 years before the original. It's going to explain the space jockey.
Who's the dead alien thing in the ship that looks like he's like the pilot. I don't know, you'll find pictures. It's easy enough.
And he's put it 30 years ahead because that gives him enough space to write two movies if the first movie actually does well,
yeah,
which I have no hope, but whatever. And they're supposedly redesigning the alien, which, you know, kind of makes me sad because I love the alien. You know, that's like the weirdest space monster ever. It's so cool.
I'm not sure why they would redo the alien. I mean, unless they bring in H.R. Giger again.
Who?
The guy who created the aliens originally. He was the...
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, if they bring him in and they just wanted to maybe spruce it up a little bit to make it more... Like, because, I mean, the originals are kind of like robotic-y. Like, maybe to make them more fluid? I don't know.
But, you know, 30 years, why would you... That's not enough time, I don't... Even for the aliens to like, evolve away from their body structure, is it? So it just doesn't really make much sense. I mean, if it was 30,000 years, then I'd see why you do a redesign, but 30 years is just going to make it confusing.
Well, this is 30 years before, so, I mean, they wouldn't even have... They would have to have been similar to the aliens you'd see in Alien. At least you would think, but I also don't know enough about the physiology, so... Whether or not they take characteristics from the creatures that they spawn out of, I don't know.
But, you know, don't the latter Alien movies take place hundreds of years after the first one?
No. Aliens is just long enough for Ripley's daughter to have died. So, like, 60 years, maybe? That's a guess. I'd have to rewatch the film, because I'm sure it says the difference in the years, and you can tell the years. I'm sure some aliens nut will know. And then the one after that is also not terribly distant.
But it's still more distant than 30 years, and they haven't changed much over the films. You know, like their neck frills might have a different number of, you know, divots, but whatever.
Well, but they also, in for example, for Aliens, it's the same ship as in the originals, and they're just dormant in the egg things. And then in Alien 3, the queen is actually inside her. She's, like, it gets inside her in the ship while she's in the whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, there wasn't any time for that to be, for there to be any evolution. There was no conditions that would have allowed it. They were all sort of in stasis until they got a host, so...
I mean, it still seems an odd choice, especially, you know, I mean, whenever you're going to change something in such a storied franchise, I don't understand Scott's decision.
I don't really know. I mean, maybe that'll be really good, maybe it'll just be a pile of garbage. I mean, to be fair, I just saw Robin Hood recently, and I think I've said before it wasn't all that great, so...
Yeah, most people are just ripped it apart. Is it even still in theaters? No, I don't think so. I mean,
some places I'm sure it still is. It's not here.
Well, some places Avatar is still in theaters.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Some places it's still here. And I'm sure it's now coming out in England. So, but yeah, it's not a very good movie. Yeah.
Okay. Well, and our final article, do you have anything else to say about that?
Oh, no. I was just going to say, speaking of movies.
Richard Matheson, who, you know, wrote I Am Legend. If you know me, you know how much I just completely adore Richard Matheson.
Yeah.
His story, Real Steel, is getting a film adaptation. And it's about a future where robot boxing is quite popular, and it's centered around a struggling promoter who's going to be played by Hugh Jackman.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And Jackman thinks he's found, you know, champion a discarded robot. And then, you know, while he's... coaching this discarded robot, you know, to the top of the heap, he discovers he has an 11-year-old son who wants to know his father, so it has kind of a twist in there.
Well, it's not really a twist. Like, the story centers around the father and son narrative, and then it has... It's sort of like how they bond through robot boxing, so...
Well, I've actually haven't read this Richard Matheson story, but that would make sense for Matheson, because he always, you know, makes it about, like, really, really about the characters, like, overwhelmingly so.
Yeah.
It's directed by Sean Levy, who directed Date Night, Pink Panther, Night at the Museum, so...
And some episodes from The Secret World of Alex Mack. Woo!
Which I remember from when I was a kid, and it seemed goofy then, but I still watched it.
Yep.
And that's produced by Steven Spielberg, which, again, that seriously doesn't mean much to me. But it's supposed to have 19 real-life animatronic robots for the movie.
They actually created them. They used them in the film for the interactions between the humans, so...
I mean, I'm excited. I don't think we've had a movie like this come out ever.
We had stuff similar. I think there was, like, RoboJocks. Wasn't that a similar, like, giant robots fighting for... I know,
but this is, like, human-sized robots.
Well, they're, like, 8 feet tall robots, so I mean,
but if they get the dynamic between the father and son right, it doesn't matter what else is going to go on. It's going to be a great movie, and that's really what they need to focus on. The rest is just gravy, but they have to get that right.
Yeah, definitely. And Hugh Jackman's a pretty good actor, so maybe it'll turn out good.
Yeah, I'm hopeful, but then again, you know, when they did the newest I Am Legend was blah, fun, but not Matheson stuff at all.
Well, I liked it. But
it was fun, but it wasn't, you know, Matheson's I Am Legend. I honestly don't even know why they used the name for the recognition, but unless you're into speculative fiction, you're not going to recognize that name either. I mean, even when they did the you know, the Omega Man and the other one, and the other remake of it, when the book was, you know, big when it was first came out, they didn't use I Am Legend. So I just don't understand there. But I could talk about that for a whole podcast. And that will just about do it for news this week. We will be right back with our main discussion segment. And we're back with our main discussion, which is something we've been, you know, planning on doing for a while. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be controversial. And we're probably going to contradict ourselves multiple times during this discussion. So there is your warning. And our main discussion topic is, what is and what constitutes science fiction?
I'm going to let you go. You're starting.
No, I introduced it. You are going to start.
I'm not starting.
Okay, we'll both give our opening little snippets and then we'll discuss it.
I don't have a prepared statement. What are you talking about?
I do.
You wrote a prepared statement for this segment?
Yeah. I mean, this is a big deal.
Oh my gosh. You're insane, man. It's fantastic. I don't have a prepared statement. I don't really know what science fiction is.
Are you serious? You've had a whole week to think about this, and you didn't come up with anything.
No, I just I just didn't think too much.
You can't just give any sort of insight into what you're gonna, you know, be arguing with me about for the next 15 minutes.
Honestly, because I would rather just refute what you say, because it's much easier.
You can't just refute what I say.
I find it much easier to say what science fiction isn't than it is saying what it is.
But that isn't the discussion.
Well, I realize that,
what
but...
What is science fiction? You have to have an is part. You
it's
can't
a genre of literature there.
If you're just going to refute me, I'm not even going to read my prepared statement.
My prepared statement, then, is science fiction is a genre of literature.
No, what constitutes science fiction? You know, you know, you are making a bad case for your being Skiffy right now. Skiffy would have a logically produced and grammatically correct statement to read.
Mine is a logically produced and grammatically correct statement. I mean, technically speaking, if we're going to get down to it, science fiction is a genre of literature.
It's a genre. Well, if you want to, it's a collective, you know, group of images and art. Because it's not a genre if you're going to get down to specifics.
No, it is. It's a genre.
In the layman's terms, not in the academic terms.
No, even in academic terms, it's a genre.
The genres are story, novella, novel.
Nope. Oh, I'm an academic.
I am one, too. And I go to a small school in northern Wisconsin. So
I go to one of the largest schools in the country.
I know, you're just a knowledge, it's just a knowledge factory. You have no insight.
No,
they want you for your money.
I go to school for free. They pay me to go here.
Oh, that you are so wrong.
Whatever.
Anyway, okay, so I don't really have a written statement, but I do know what I'm going to say somewhat. In this overarching, you know, realm of genres and subgenres that most people term speculative fiction, which includes science fiction, fantasy, and to a lesser extent, horror.
And alternate history.
Which I include in the first two.
Nope, doesn't belong there. It belongs to its own genre.
Will you quit interrupting my prepared statement, sir?
No. This is not a political debate.
Okay, so if we ignore the rude interloper, we will go on. In the overarching umbrella of speculative fiction, what makes stories differ for me and allows me to categorize them in my own way is science fiction stories, their unrealistic elements come some way, somehow, from real-world science that has been done or that can be extrapolated to see where the science comes from, but, you know, it has to all lead back to the present, you know, or the past, you know, somehow. And fantasy are all those things that are explained by, like, magic and prophecies and folklore versus science, which is science fiction, which should have some semblance of recognizable science in it.
So you're saying that that prophecies may not exist in science fiction?
I'm not saying, I mean, you could have a science fiction story with prophecies in it, because that could be an aspect of, you know, time travel or something. But you'd have to describe why there is you don't have to describe everything in science fiction in scientific rigor, just the scales have to be tipped in favor of science fiction. I mean, planetary romance, for the most part, has very fantasy-rich elements, but a science fiction setting, you know, which is why a lot of people put that subgenre into the science fiction side of things, even though a lot of it is fantasy. Same with, you know, steampunk. A lot of steampunk is fantasy, but the technology, if you think about it, is quite logical, and you can see where it comes from.
I don't consider steampunk fantasy or science fiction. It's alternate history.
I think you can place in either fantasy or science fiction, depending on which side, what, you know, which of those genres tip the scales.
It can't be science fiction. Alternate history cannot be science fiction.
Most subgenres are in a gray middle zone anyway, and this is just how I mean, because, you know, I run on the weird side. I go alternating days throughout the week, science fiction and fantasy reviews, and this is how I decide where to put them.
Right, but alternate history is not science fiction or fantasy. It can be neither. It can have elements of both, but it's neither.
See, I didn't think alternate history was science fiction for a long time, but I am conceding that it can be.
But it can't, because it's inevitably about the past. And the one feature that any science fiction story has to have, it has to be about the future.
Isn't Star Wars a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away?
Yeah, but I don't consider Star Wars science fiction.
You have got to be kidding me.
I consider Star Wars science fantasy. If we're talking in hard terms, if we are sitting here defining what we think they are, I consider it science fantasy. If we're talking in terms of what we want to label things in the world outside for like the purpose of selling books or selling movies or whatever, I would call Star Wars science fiction, just because to have to sit here and explain to people why it's not science fiction is not the point of the label.
But as a science fiction author, you should want to describe it to them. You want to set them right that Star Wars looks like science fiction, sounds like science fiction, but as heart is a secondary world fantasy.
No, because trying to explain to them what that is not productive. It's not going to do anything.
I mean, Star Wars is mostly planetary romance separated by short sequences of unscientific space opera.
It's space opera.
It's mostly planetary romance.
They're almost exactly the same thing.
No, planetary romance takes place on planets. Space opera takes place in space.
Not true. Not true.
Yeah.
You need
to learn
the history. Learn the history of space opera, because
I have the space opera renaissance right here.
The term doesn't. Space opera may include intergalactic. It may include cross-planetary stories.
I'm not saying it takes place solely in space, but if the majority of it takes place on a planet, then it's planetary romance.
No. Planetary romance is largely for action that takes place generally in one place, such as what you would get with Edgar Rice Burroughs' the Mars series, in which all the stories take place on Mars. Whereas with space opera, it may take place on planets, but it's generally includes such things as space battles, high-flying adventure, and so on. If you look up the genre, that's what it is. And then when you look at Star Wars, you realize that actually that's exactly what Star Wars is. And even if you just take your planetary romance thing, well, a huge portions of Star Wars take place in space, not on planets. Sections of it take place on planets, but there are huge sections. Most of Empire Strikes Back, for example, is in space.
I still think it's mostly planetary romance separated by short sequences of space opera.
Well, then you're just ignoring reality.
And old school space opera, not new space opera, because new space opera is not about the fun and the high-flying adventure. It's about crazy far future ideas and very rigorous science, and quite cool, actually.
Yeah, but original space opera, in fact, the term was invented by a guy in, like, 1941 specifically to talk about literature that they considered at the time to be like pulpy, high adventure, interplanetary, multi-planet, multi-solar system stuff. It was originally a derogatory term. It was not like what we consider space opera now, which is a sort of a descriptive term. I'm just telling you that the term at the time, what was space opera and what still is space opera, is not the same thing as what you want it to be.
What I want it to be. It's what I perceive it to be.
Right, but when you ignore the fact that Star Wars is, in fact, a space opera, you're wanting it to be something that it's...
Again, parts of it are planetary romance, and parts of it are space opera.
Right, but when you look at the definition for planetary romance, and then you look at the definition for space opera, they're basically the same thing.
But whose definition? Because I've read many different definitions of both of them.
Typically the people who actually write it, but, you know.
Well, I write it.
Yeah,
write
but
both.
you are not a person who's going to be changing the genre right now.
So you don't know that. You don't know what I got in the works.
Tomorrow you're not going... The genre is not going to go, oh, Adam Calloway totally revolutionized science fiction tomorrow. It's not going to happen.
It might happen.
It might happen in 10 years.
It probably will happen.
Maybe in 50 years, or it might happen at all.
Maybe not tomorrow, because, you know, it's Sunday, and you're not supposed to work on Sundays. But come Monday, you might hear that a sea change is taking place.
Anyway, but really, this is all, like, side, subgenre deciding stuff. This isn't really deciding what science fiction is. But if there's one element that all science fiction must have for me, it must be about the future. Period.
Well, there's contemporary science fiction that takes place now.
It's not science fiction then.
So, like, the stuff Futurismic publishes isn't science fiction?
No, because Futurismic is near future.
Well, near future could be tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's science fiction.
If it takes place tomorrow, it's science fiction, but if it takes place today,
it could be. Not everything that takes place in the future is necessarily science fiction, because I could write a story about tomorrow that has no other elements that could be defined as science fiction. But a science fiction story must be about the future, whether that's an hour from now or 10,000 years. It must be about the future, period.
But that's just one element of a definition of science fiction.
I know, but so many things get knocked out immediately just by using that definition. That immediately throws out, you can't talk about fantasy. Fantasy
time travel?
No longer. Time travel is different because it's about stuff taking place in the future than going back in time, so it requires a future perspective to imagine the ability to go back in time.
Well, I mean, what about, like, 1984? I mean, it was written in 1940, but it was about 1984, and we're in 2010 now, so it technically doesn't look towards the future.
You also have to take into account the times it was written, because if we do that, then 2001 Space Odyssey no longer applies, because obviously we're well past 2001. Or 2010, yeah. So you have to take into account when it was written. If it was written in, you know, 1948 or and so on for 1984, it's still a science fiction story. It may not have come true, but I don't think that science fiction is necessarily about predicting things. So I don't think that's a requirement of science fiction to predict, if that makes sense.
So it has to be about, it has to look towards the future, but it doesn't have to predict the future.
Its purpose isn't to predict what actually will happen. Its purpose is to think about the future, to extrapolate upon the present and the past for what could be, but not necessarily will be.
So why can't you extrapolate on the past, though? Like, why wouldn't alternate history be science fiction?
Because it isn't set in our current sort of universe. It's set in an alternate universe. It's always going to be about the past. It's going to be about a what if of a past situation, and it's set in a universe that isn't our own, so it doesn't belong.
I don't like that definition.
Sorry, alternate history is not about the future, it's about the past.
I know, but how, like, a lot of alternate history is, you know, people would say that the what if question lies at the heart of science fiction, and alternate history is all about the what if.
Yeah, I don't agree that the what if question is necessarily at the heart. I think it is. It's a integral part of it, but when you throw in the other elements that belong in science fiction, it throws out other stuff.
See, I just think alternate history, you have to look, and steampunk and coal punk and whatever else you want to throw in there, you have to look on a story to story basis.
Nope.
But again, we're back into subgenres, man. We got to stay on the science fiction. What is science fiction? I think that the science fiction, you know, in 90% of the cases has to have science that you can, that is believable, or at least explanations that are believable in a scientific sense. Like a lot of the stuff you're in hard science fiction, it honestly just could be all garbage. It's so tough to decode the wordage and all that. But I think a lot of science fiction, you know, at least should have a logical explanation that uses, you know, like our universe to describe it.
I disagree that it needs to be described. I agree that it has to have some science in it, but I disagree that it has to be described.
If it doesn't need to be described, then science fiction's only an aesthetic genre.
It's not necessarily true. From a literary perspective, info dumping is bad.
But, you know, it's that you don't have to describe things through info dumping.
Oh, no, I wrote a post about this recently, but that's... The point is, I don't think that the science necessarily has to be described. I don't need for something to be science fiction for them to explain how a ray gun works in some way, whether that be in dialogue or whatever. It's a ray gun.
But that ray gun might as well be powered by unicorn dust, you know, if you don't explain it, and then it would be fantasy.
The chances that a ray gun is going to be powered by unicorn dust is really not likely.
Why not?
Because they're making an assumption about a vision of the future that is just kind of a ridiculous assumption. It's like, well, it could be, you know, it could be powered by your hair or you know, alien baby feet. I mean, like, it could be powered by anything, but that's not really relevant.
Yeah, but it should be relevant if you want to call your story science fiction.
I disagree. I don't care how the ray gun works.
In the title.
I understand that, but I don't care how the ray gun works, just that it works.
Well, that's not, you know, the science fiction, you know, that's not where it came from. Science fiction was about, you know, John W. Campbell made it about the scientific rigor involved in making science fiction.
He didn't invent science fiction.
He didn't invent it, but he kind of, you know, put it on the path to having science in it for once.
Yeah, but he was only one person in a group of people.
I know that. I'm just saying that science fiction should have science. Otherwise, why would you even care to call it science
fiction? The science is there, though. If there's a ray gun in the story,
implied
the science,
science
is there.
Implied science is not science. You can imply anything. You know, if I haven't read science fiction, I'm not going to, you know, think that ray gun is powered by any sort of, you know, like free electron laser or something. I'm just going to think whatever I want to think about how that ray gun is powered. Why? I mean, I could think ray gun's a fancy term for Beretta for all it matters then.
No, you're just being ridiculous now.
Why am I being ridiculous? Because I think science fiction should have science in it?
No, because you make assumptions that if somebody says a ray gun, that you make a whole bunch of assumptions about what a ray gun is while ignoring like the history of what a ray gun actually is. Like, you can't take a ray gun and like, oh, well, it could just be a Beretta, but like, well, then the author would have just said it's a Beretta. He wouldn't have said, aha, it's a ray gun.
But ray guns have been so many different things throughout science fiction's history. You have to, you know, tell what type of ray gun it is.
No, you don't.
Otherwise, you know, it's a Star Trek phaser.
It could be. Why does it matter what kind of gun it is? It's just a gun. It shoots people. It kills people. Why does it matter?
If that is what makes your story science fiction, I would not call your story science fiction.
I don't think that's what makes your story science fiction, but I don't think that not describing how the ray gun works and what powers it suddenly makes it not science fiction. Because if that's true, then there's nothing in your definition that is science fiction. Because there are every story does not explain how every piece of technology...
I already said that it doesn't need to explain how every piece of technology works. It just has to explain... It has to just have to tip the scales away from fantasy in some way.
But what is fantasy about a ray gun?
Ray gun and magic wand are the same thing if you don't describe them.
I disagree. Because with the description of a magic wand would specifically be he's using magic. You don't, like, say, oh, I'm going to flap around a stick and then things will happen. Like, no, he's going to say, I'm using my magic wand or I'm casting a spell with the wand or whatever. It'll be described that that's what's happening. With a ray gun, he's shooting somebody with a ray gun. The implications are there.
But, you know, ray gun is an amorphous, you know, term. What kind of rays? You know, gamma rays, microwaves? That depends. And that simple fact, you know, will lead to other repercussions. Well, how is that powered, you know? And what will it do to the person it's hitting or the object it's hitting? And these are the questions that you need to ask yourself when you're writing science fiction.
I disagree. If I want to use a ray gun, I'm just going to use a ray gun. I don't need to describe how it works.
Okay.
That's not what matters in science fiction.
I'm not saying that's what matters. I'm saying what makes something science fiction.
Well, I disagree that you'd have to have this described accurate science. Or, well, the, you didn't say accurate, but you did say that the science has to be described. I completely disagree.
Some aspect of the story has to be described, you know, why it's like that.
I don't think that's strictly necessary for science fiction. I think the science needs to be present, but it doesn't necessarily need to be described.
I mean, even if you're looking at, you know, just crazy weird science fiction stories like the stuff Jason Sanford writes, he still has, you know, just some description in his story about why the things are that way.
Kind of, yeah, but he also doesn't describe loads of other things that, like, for example, sublimation angels. He never describes the aliens. He talks about the aliens, and they have apparently the ability to do things that humans can't, but we never actually understand how they do that. There's no explanation for how that works. For all we know, that's just magic.
But from the character's point of view, they never figure out any, like, hardly anything about the orals, I think they're
right.
called.
Right, so it could just be magic.
Exactly, but in that case, they don't need to be described. I mean, you can't just describe everything from a narrator's point of view. But now we're getting into craft versus genre.
But you would still call sublimation angels science fiction.
Definitely.
Well, that defeats your definition that goes right out the window.
He describes the reason they're there. He describes some of the technology. He describes the way that, you know, oxygen, it sublimates, you know, after, you know, they dig it out from under this mirrored ash. He describes some aspects, and that's what tilts it away from being fantasy.
I disagree. I don't think the description has to be there for it to be science fiction. I just completely disagree with that. He could have written the story and focused instead on the characters instead of the science, and it would still be science fiction. We're never going to agree on that point, because you want described science, and I don't care either way. And that creates the line for you.
Exactly. I mean, otherwise, you have no standards for science fiction.
No, I have standards. My standards are pretty clear. It needs to be about the future.
It needs to be about the future.
Yep, it needs to be about the future. The science needs to be at least implied.
Well, what about, like, Gene Wolfe's The Book of the New Sun?
I never read The Book of the New Sun.
That takes place on a future Earth where, you know, the sun has gone all crazy, but to a lot of people it would seem like secondary world fantasy.
Well, I haven't read it, so I have no comment.
Okay.
So, well, because I'm not going to comment on a book I haven't read. Sorry.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, you have to have more than just those little reasons.
Those seem pretty much good enough for me. It's about the future, and it has implied science.
Implied science is so
at the very least. At the very least, the science needs to be implied.
I mean, a lot of the future tech in science fiction comes from the author's implications of current technology.
And?
So, I mean, I just don't think that you can only have implied science, because then you're assuming, you're putting way too much on the reader to assume the correct things to make your story make sense.
Not
I mean, if
really.
if you're writing, like, psychology-based social science fiction, then whatever, you know, that science doesn't matter anyway because it's not really science. But if you're writing...
There you go with that nonsense again.
If you're writing real science fiction, then...
That's a distinction I'm not going to make, because social science is real science.
Yeah, to some.
It's real science to scientists, so...
Yeah, if you can call them that.
You're just really condescending.
Well, there are some sciences that have absolutes where things don't change, and then you have the social
science.
There
are no sciences that have absolutes. None.
Physics. Math.
Does not have absolutes.
Yes, they do.
Nope.
Yes,
they do. No such thing as an absolute in science. It's
none. Okay.
There's no such thing.
Okay.
There's not. We name one absolute.
The speed of light in a vacuum is an absolute... thing.
That
it goes 186,000 miles per second.
That is not a scientific concept. That is a universal constant. It's a difference.
All science comes from the universe and its constants.
It's based on the constants, but our understanding of what makes the universe operate is malleable. That is what science is. Science is the understanding of the universe. Universal constants don't generally change. They get more accurate, sure, but our understanding of things that operate within the universe is malleable.
Well, then there is no point to science.
No, there's a huge point to science.
And all scientists are glorified archaeologists just discovering things and never, you know, there's no point to it.
No, there is a point. The there, just because saying there's no such thing as an absolute in science doesn't suddenly mean that science isn't relevant. It's absolutely 100% relevant. Understanding.
No, that's not. It's that you're not like the things you're picking and choosing what counts as a discovery.
No, not really.
Someone discovered that the speed of light moved 186,000 miles per second,
mm-hmm.
just like someone discovered how to make plutonium.
Kind of different processes, but okay.
I know they're different processes, but they're both discoveries.
Yeah, but they're different kinds of discoveries.
Oh, come on. Now you're splitting hairs, sir.
No, one involves direct human interaction with the medium. The other one does not.
It required direct human interaction. They had to build the sensors and devise the experiments and the equations to figure out
how to find. They didn't have to create the speed. The speed always was there.
And,
that's the difference.
The ability to make plutonium was always there.
The ability was there, but the object itself was not. You're comparing ability with actual thing.
You're comparing.
I have the ability to fly, I'm sure, but I'm not going to.
No.
Yeah, I can go get
Unless
in an airplane.
Unless you have a biplane, but you know that's.
I can go get in an airplane right now.
That's technically flying, but it's not bodily flying.
I could jump outside my apartment right now. I wouldn't fly very far, but I'd
that's
fly.
That's not flying. That's falling. Flying requires a concerted effort.
I would. I would be flapping my arms really fast.
Well, if you got any altitude from that, then you're flying. Otherwise, you're falling.
I would have, you know, for a moment. Anyway, point is, there are no absolutes in science, within science. Evolution is not an absolute.
That's why it's a theory. It's not a law. Laws are given to be absolute.
Nope.
That's why it's a law. Laws you can't break.
That's a very, very odd understanding of science. Laws break, too.
Law of gravity.
Laws break. Our understanding of the laws change. There's a difference.
The law of inertia.
Gravity is actually a theory. It's not a law.
No, it's the law of gravity.
No, it's a theory of gravity. Gravity is not a law.
It's the law of gravity.
Well, then somebody lied, because it's never actually been tagged as a law. It's always been a theory. Even so, it's a very odd law in your world if it's an absolute, because our understanding of gravity frequently changes.
Our understanding of it, but it's always there. We understand the basics of it.
The force is there, but that's... That's...
And it's like it's what we're using gravity for, not gravity itself, not Newton's inverse square law. Even if it seems like some things are breaking, you know, the inverse square law, there is going to inevitably be something behind that is not gravitational.
And you're degrading theories, since theories are not like
bunk.
Just haphazard bunk stuff that they just
throw
out.
They might as well be. You know, they could be.
They're not. That is not what a scientific theory is.
A theory is an educated guess. That's what it is.
No, it's not. It is not. In science, it is not an educated guess.
Maybe not in science.
No. In actual science. See, now you're just you've completely don't even know what science is. In actual science, a theory is a hypothesis which has been tested and which has amounted vast amounts of evidence in its favor and has been peer-reviewed. Nothing becomes a theory just because, that's a theory. It's the theory of ninjas or whatever. That's not how it works in science. Nothing becomes a theory without being rigorously tested and put to the test of peer review. Period.
Okay.
That's what science is. Ask a scientist.
I know about the process of science, but anyone can put forth a theory. That's why theory.
People can say something is a theory, but what they actually mean is it's a hypothesis. In science, there's no such thing as a theory without evidence.
Theory and a hypothesis are basically the same thing.
No, a hypothesis is a claim. A theory is the claim with the evidence to support it.
If it has evidence to support it, it would probably become a law.
No, because things don't become laws just because it has evidence to support it. That's not how it works.
Well, you have to prove that it works 100% of the time. In almost every circumstance.
That's the problem. That's not what happens in science. It's called gravitation theory, my friend.
No, it's Newton's law of universal gravitation.
Yeah.
But...
I think I'm getting confused with how gravity is used with general relativity. I think that's the problem.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because when we're talking in general relativity, there's a relativistic theory of gravity. But when we're talking about... gravity in the Newton sense, that's a wholly different thing.
Most people consider our universe Newtonian.
I like Einstein. He's much more interesting.
But Einstein didn't comment on everything.
Well, no, he died.
And he used Newton to
anyway,
come up.
We're just like going so far off. The whole point of trying to get through all that discussion is that theories are not like happenstance. Just, oh, I made a theory. It's not how it works in science.
Maybe not a reputable theory, but reputable. People
who say this is a theory and then just that's just it. That's a theory that I don't have to discuss it anymore. People who say that are idiots.
Okay, but they can still say it.
They can still say it, but it doesn't make it a scientific theory.
There you go. But this again, we're getting away from what is science fiction.
Yeah, well, we've.
But you know,
I don't think we can, because the one thing that it seems like we disagree on is the issue of science. That for me, at the very least, I need implied science. For you, you need explicit science, and that's the difference.
Somewhere explicit.
Yeah, well, you need explicit. I need at least implied.
I mean, I need effort. I will call things science fiction without explicit science, but I don't feel good about it. Like the ray gun, a love story, which, you know, that came out, I think, last year. Spectacular, you know, story, but mm-hmm. in it, it has a ray gun and nothing about it is explained. And it seems like science fiction, but in my definition, it wouldn't be science fiction. It wouldn't be fantasy. It would just be it. It's in this weird gray area. So, yeah. I mean, I don't adhere hard and fast to my rules. I mean, J.G. Ballard's stories they don't really have, like, much science in it. They might have, like, something put forth by Freud, but because he logically takes that to its conclusions, I consider him science fiction.
Okay, so you aren't...
I think science fiction has to be logical in a more realistic way, because you can have logical fantasy, you know? But
you can't have logical fantasy?
No, you can. You definitely can. If it's not logical, then it's comic, which is a different genre.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people create these magic systems to make fantasy logical, you know, magic based on this or this. I mean, it's every bit as logical as science fiction. It's just where that logic comes from is what determines if I deem it science fiction or fantasy. That's really what it comes down to, is where the logic for the fantastic things come from.
Yeah, but I think the problem with that is that you make assumptions of where that logic comes from.
How so?
If it's not explained to you, like in the case of the ray gun, like the first thing you said when I brought that up was, well, it could be powered by unicorn dust. So for you as a reader, you go to assumptions that other readers might not go to.
Oh, no, I assume that the ray gun shoots a Star Wars, Star Trek-esque laser beam when I read it. I'm just saying because I want, you know, some sort of definition I can go to, but we're not going to get there. And I was just, you know, doing it for the sake of argument.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well.
Because I do think that you have to have, you know, I want, you know, accountability for the science, I guess. That's what I want. I don't get that. And that's maybe why people think science fiction isn't, you know, where it should be as a genre right now. But that's what I want. So if someone explains to me why the steampunk robot works, you know, through gears and stuff, that is science fiction to me, because they logically explained it using, you know, real world, you know, things.
Well, OK, it's alternate history, which isn't sci-fi, but we've already talked about that. So we won't go into that again.
You.
What?
No, you had to get the last word on alternate history. I'm not, you know, a huge fan of it, but, you know, I just, you know, read that What Dr. Gottlieb Saw by, you know, Ian Tregillis, and it's alternate history, but and it's just, you know, it's strange because it's both science fiction and fantasy.
Oh, well.
But, like, what about Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle? Is that not science fiction?
Nope, it's alternate history. I have to draw you a picture of where everything goes.
No, there's a Venn diagram, and alternate history is in the middle.
What do you mean in the middle?
I mean, science fiction is on one side of the diagram, fantasy is on the other, and where they overlap, you have alternate history and steampunk. Anything that takes place in the past is in the middle.
Okay, yeah, well, kind of like it in the middle, yeah. I mean, it has both aspects of both genres, it's just not either genre.
Well, the mere fact that, you know, it's in the past is fantasy, that it takes place, like, that's the point of view of it, and there's no time travel involved.
Exactly. So it's not either. It's its own thing. Alternate history, its own little thing.
That's why I look at, you know, what seems to be more of a presence. I mean, if it's real-world alternate history, I'm probably going to call it science fiction. If it's, you know, like, if it has you know, the Greek gods coming back to destroy the Third Reich, then it's fantasy.
Anyway, so we're kind of, I don't think we really got anywhere with this. But then again, to be fair, like, every discussion about what science fiction is has never got anywhere. So, like, we were expecting to get somewhere.
We're doing this for fun and to create banter among our, you know, rabid fans.
Yeah, yeah.
Now they can talk to us at our convention, the Skiffian Fanty Convention.
It's really, yeah. What? I was just thinking, like, right in the middle you said that, and then I, like, got really confused. Like, a convention, all right. Oh.
Hey, if someone made a Skiffian Fanty Convention, I would show up it as a guest of honor.
Well, we would have to be guests of honor. We're the hosts. But anyway, we need to. I think we've kind of covered it as best we can. We kind of had a big digression into science in which there was confusion.
We'll talk about it again, inevitably, because we both care about this subject.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have to, at some point, have a better discussion about why science is not absolute, in which I don't bring up the theory of gravity and...
Law of gravity.
In the theory of general relativity sense... Which is different, which is what I was basing it on, which was not the same thing as Newton's laws.
But you're right. For the most part, theories have to have science. I agree with that. I was just playing devil's advocate again.
I know,
because,
but it's...
Because, you know, there are, like, theories like the variable speed of light theory, where light traveled, you know, at a different speed in the early universe that, you know, is a theory but doesn't really have much to stand behind it besides some obscure mathematical concepts.
Yeah, so that's the thing I have a problem with, like, experimental physics and stuff like that. A lot of people in that segment of the scientific community, they just attach theory to everything, and I think that's led to a lot of public confusion about what a theory actually is, because you have all these people who just say, oh, well, evolution is just a theory, but as if that's an insult. But within science, how science is supposed to work, when evolution is a theory, that's not like I just, like, pooped out the an answer while I was, like, on the John. Like, no. Like, that, there's all of this stuff they've collected for it, all of this research for this thing. And I think within experimental physics, they just attach theory to stuff when they don't have any evidence for it. Like, string theory, for example, not a lot of actual evidence for string theory, but they just call it string theory. It's not a theory. It's a hypothesis.
Experimental physics, or not experimental, but theoretical physics, that's all it is. It's all theory, you know? It's based on math and... nothing really else, because you can't test it. I mean, the Large Hadron Collider will take us back to, you know, time that, you know, that seems really close to the Big Bang. You know, the conditions in the early universe are what they think, but it's still, you'll never get close enough to the Big Bang to verify this theory, or even the energies. I mean, gosh, you'd have to, you know, take the entire mass of the universe to get those energies. So
yeah,
I think it's just physicists who are really good mathematicians and like to think a lot. That's where you get theoretical physics. And if string theory turns out to be true, I will eat my socks.
It's a very bizarre hypothesis.
11-dimensional quantum chromodynamics.
Hey, the 11 dimensions are fun. Anyway, if any of you guys want to let us know what you think about all this, or disagree with me, or yell at me for confusing Newtonian laws with general relativity, which was my stupid mistake, I don't feel like a moron for that.
Oh, I probably said things that people hate me for, too. I don't know.
Oh, well...
I hope we get some mail for once, you know, because I think this is a subject that should continually be talked about. I mean, a lot of people say that categorization kills genres, but I think it's, you know, what... reinvents them. I mean, you need to look at something in depth to be able to reinvent it in the first place. I mean, the New Wave came about because they looked at the Golden Age and didn't like what it was doing.
Figures. Well, maybe we'll look back and we'll go, I don't like anything that's going on right now. Let's make the Shenatom Wave.
Maybe we'll create the brand new... Maybe it's our impetus. You know, the next big thing in science fiction came from here.
Yes, it'll be the Shenatom Wave.
How come you get the first syllable?
Because Adamashan doesn't sound right.
Neither of it sounds right. How about Shenatom. We call it, you know, the Wave of Awesome?
Because that's just ridiculous. Shenatom is so much better.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to leave it on that. You know, guys, look forward to the Shenatom Wave. It'll be coming into stores near you soon.
Sounds like She Adam.
No, Shen Adam.
Okay, we'll be right back with our closing bits. Stay tuned.
And we're back. We're going to do our reading and writing segment bit. I'm not really writing anything, but I'm reading a whole bunch of stuff because I just started school again. So I'm reading lots of things that are very boring and not as interesting. So I don't have much of interest to say, except for that I'm reading Dr. Identity still and some other books and not a lot of fun. Yeah. And I haven't had a chance to really do much new writing. I try to poke my head into some other stuff, but mostly I've got stories that I'm going to send you, Adam, pretty soon here. Well, depending on which ones you want. So I'm really boring this week for this discussion, so it's up to you to be interesting.
Well, that is no problem, because I am always interesting.
Well, I'm not always.
It's rude. I'm working on a story about a guy who is who continually keeps layering more dimensions on top of himself so he can see the inner workings of the universe and eventually annihilate God, who's made of antimatter.
Oh, well, that's not science himself. Fiction.
I know, right? It's it's sci-fi strange. Come on. And I'm actually trying to work on the science behind it just to F with people. I think I'm going to start, you know, working on a novel because I'm starting to realize that short stories aren't going to get me anywhere in this community right now. So I think I'm going to start working. I don't know which one, and it will probably change multiple times, but I think I can get a first draft done by the time college starts up again.
Oh, just realized I am starting a novel, but we can talk about that off podcast because I want to keep it secret because I have a plan for it. So.
Okay. And I've you know, I'm in the middle of so many books. I finished The City and the City by China Mieval, which I only had a few pages left for months and months and months because I just got distracted. And I finally finished it, and it was awesome and incredible and just reaffirmed my beliefs that, yeah, it should have won the Nebula. and I'm still in the middle of The Adamantine Palace and Gardens of the Sun, and I just bought Ghosts of Manhattan by George Mann, which looks too darn cool not to get too soon. So I'm just going to hammer out these novels, you know. I haven't been writing much, so I could do some reading, but I'll have, you know, a review of The City and the City and every book I finish up on the weird side, and I will let you know next week that these fine viewers which novel I will probably, you know, stick to.
Cool. All right, so let's just dive right into the question of the week then, and this is just a silly one I thought we would do, because we've done a lot of, like, where we want them to actually say a lot of stuff, and let's just give them something silly to play with. So the question of the week is, if you could change any part of your body into a robot part, which part would it be and why? Creative responses are much appreciated.
Inviting disaster there.
Oh, yeah, I hope we get some fun ones.
If you would like to answer that or any of the other questions or respond or hate mail, email skiffyandfanny@gmail.com. Comment on our WordPress page at skiffyandfanny.wordpress.com. Twitter us at skiffyandfanny. You know how to do that. Voicemail, have we gotten any? Don't think so. 206-337-8423.
You might get some now.
I know. Make it interesting. Use an auto-tuner. Just we'll put it on the air if you send one.
Oh, that would be great if somebody sent us, like, a response to the question in a song in auto-tune.
Yeah, a Lil Wayne response to the robot part.
That would be fantastic.
It would be fantastic. It would make my week.
All right, well, that does it for our show. We will be back next week with something else.
Yes, we will. Something else. Something completely different.
Yeah, well, just, you know. Just, I don't want them to make sure that they know that we're not repeating ourselves like we did in a certain episode.
Wait, is next week the thing that we
talk?
What
thing?
The thing, you know, the exciting thing that was similar to the other thing.
No. I haven't officially set up the thingy thing.
But soon there will be a thing.
Yeah, there will be a thing. It'll be very exciting, this thing that we're calling the thing because it's exciting.
Okay.
It's thing-like. Yeah.
Well, so stay tuned for the thing. We will talk to you next week. We'll talk at you next week.
Yeah, talking at you. All right, we'll be back next week, guys.
Bye-bye.
Autobots, roll out!